Hi everybody, and welcome to the first Edinburgh International Film Festival podcast from theoneliner.com. I am Scott Morris, and joining me is Drew Tavendale.
Good evening.
This year's film festival is a little earlier than usual, but, well, makes no odds to us, I guess. But we'll see if that works in box office terms by the end of the festival. It's just kicking off for the public just now with The Edge of Love, which will be getting the red carpet treatment as one of the big British films to appear at it. Of course, we've seen it early, so we get to talk about it first.
Oh, the joy.
Yeah, it may be the great white hope of the British film festival circuit, but it's not actually particularly good. It tells the tale, such as it is, of the poet Dylan Thomas, played here by Matthew Rhys, during the times of World War II, as he's wandering around London, alternately capturing the bleak misery of all this death and destruction, and writing uplifting propaganda pieces for the Ministry of Truth. He's joined by his flighty wife Caitlin, played by Sienna Miller, and while they're skanking about London doing their offbeat things, they are joined by Vera Phillips, played by Keira Knightley, who happens to be Dylan's old childhood love. After a brief period of suspicion and mistrust, Caitlin and Vera become fast friends, and Vera soon catches the eye of the dashing young army captain William Killick, played by Cillian Murphy. They fall in love, get married, Cillian goes off to war, and he comes back a changed man, railing against the seeming easy life had by Dylan and his arthouse compadres while he's been off getting shot at in Greece. I believe at this point something dramatic was supposed to happen, but I'd pretty much fallen asleep by this point. And it is certainly not an interesting film. It seems to have been aiming for the dull but worthy category and ended up just being quite dull. Drew, I know you share the same opinions, but what was your take on Edge of Love?
Yeah, it was just very much the dull but dull category, and I just kind of wonder why it was made, especially given it was apparently written specifically by Keira Knightley's mother for her daughter. Why? It's just, I'm struggling to say something about it other than it's very dull and the characters are deeply unlikable. It's another film, yeah, it's very much in the mould of last year's big British thing, Atonement, which I found equally dull and without merit, where the characters are played badly, particularly Keira Knightley's case, and they're so underwritten that there was no reason to care for any of them, bar possibly Dylan Thomas, and the reason you would care for him is that you would care that he died quickly because he's a git.
It was perhaps the most underwhelming love triangle stroke quadrangle I've seen in a good long while.
There's one moment in it where Sienna Miller's Caitlin says that everybody loves Dylan, and I find myself thinking for much of the rest of the film I've thought, really? For why, Keys? For why?
I assume she was thinking everyone loves Dylan from the Magic Roundabout, but that's true. But certainly we don't like Dylan Thomas, who is an absolute fuckknuckle in this film. I'm not sure if I was actually supposed to be emphasising with him or just sort of, I don't know, railing at his... he was very kind of stereotypical poet and was often depressed for no particularly good reason, then would go off and drink because that's what they do. I don't know. It just seemed terribly underwritten and stereotypical almost. I don't know if this is supposed to be autobiographical or whatever, but I don't really care either because it was a boring film and I don't care about boring films.
He's just a deeply, deeply unpleasant character. He's an unmitigated, self-indulgent coward, and why anybody, let alone several women, would be deeply attracted to him, I've no idea at all, because I know there's something of this, the port stereotype of the sort of dark, depressed figure, but he is more just a miserable git, which I don't think is quite the same thing.
Oh, the girls love misery. I suppose, in the sake of balance, there was a few things I liked. There's the odd shot where the director, John Mabry, gets some interesting visuals into the piece. Some of it is almost bordering on strange, where there's some like early doors lighting then coupled with that Angelo Badalamenti score, which I suppose is also something of a positive. It does put one in mind of almost Mulholland Drive or some slightly surreal outing. But yeah, that soon gets overwhelmed by the sort of brown, grey, usual war film misery. And, well, as I say, just a very, very dull film.
Yeah, and I would like to make just one point too, again, about about the accents. Really, you ought not to have bothered. And Sienna Miller's accent was poor, but for the most part, Sienna Miller, in most things she's in, is determinedly adequate and entirely, utterly unmemorable for it, whereas Keira Knightley is generally not really that good.
Yeah.
And her attempt at that Welsh accent just grated, and oh dear, 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 dear.
Yeah, we normally like Cillian Murphy around here. He's been in a lot of very good films, but this is not one of them, so we'll just pretend that he's not in it and crash on regardless.
Yeah, a point about Cillian Murphy too. He was easily the best thing in it and the best actor in it, and he's the one person you felt any sympathy for at all. But that's simply due to the sheer power of his acting coming through, and rather than anything that he was given to say, because he had another character entirely underwritten. Just the fact he has some charisma, he clearly got some acting skill there. He's something like, oh, yes, when he's getting angry, okay, I suddenly empathise with him. But that was it, and that was a very small part of the film. So certainly a recommendation would be to avoid this totally, and do not believe the hype.
I should mention that at this point, we're not going to be attempting to see any of the big budget stuff, the stuff that's about to get impending widespread cinematic releases. I believe actually Edge of Love is out this Friday or something, ludicrously soon. There's also showing things like WALL-E and a few other of these things that will be in every multiplex in the country. We're really more interested in the offbeat obscure things that we can try and inform you on. One of the slightly more obscure films that have been seen is The Song of Sparrows. Drew, would you tell us about that?
I would. Yeah, this is an Iranian film, and Iranian films don't often crop up on our shores. The closest to it that I can remember in recent times being Persepolis, though that owed far more to France than Iran. So it's really rather nice to see an Iranian film, and particularly to see something depicting Iran in a way free from any agenda. And the coverage we see from Fox News and the like, and even the BBC at times, would suggest to us Westerners that Iran is full of hateful people who spend all day developing nasty nuclear weapons with which to smite the infidel. Whereas The Song of Sparrows is, I suspect, far, far closer to the truth, depicting Iran as an industrial and agricultural country that's not as poor as many, though most people are wealthy. And its life, I suspect, could just as easily be that of many other Middle Eastern countries, perhaps some of Southeast Asia and certainly parts of Latin America, you know, and suggesting a lot of life around the world isn't that different, and certainly very much contrary to the picture of Iran we're presented with day in, day out.
Yeah, where they're constantly centrifuging things to make nuclears, whatever these are.
Yes. I believe apparently the correct way to say it, if the President of the United States would live, is nuclear, despite the letters not being in that order. So anyway, let me tell you a little bit about the film itself. It stars Iranian man Reza Naji as an ostrich farm worker called Kazim. It's a hard-working family struggling to make ends meet. When his eldest daughter loses her hearing aid into a sludge-filled water storage unit, he must find the money to repair or replace it quickly, as her school exams are only a short time away. Unfortunately, as you'd imagine, this worry about his daughter affects his concentration at work, and one of his very valuable charges on the ostrich farm escapes, leading to his employers letting him go just as he needs more money. He visits nearby Tehran, the capital of Iran, the next day to consult a doctor about his daughter's hearing aid, and he inadvertently becomes one of the city's fleet of motorcycle taxis. He realises this could be the job for him, certainly, right away getting paid rather well for it, certainly better than he had been on the ostrich farm. So he begins transporting people and goods back and forth across the city and making quite a lot of money. And at first, though, he finds it very difficult. The city is very, very impersonal compared to his very friendly rural community. But he's set up home in the metropolis and zooming back and forth, and also taking advantage of the massive amounts of scrap that Tehran seems to be repleting, and he's soon hoarded a huge pile of stuff. Anything from old television antennas to window frames, doors, and old boilers. Unfortunately, the more stuff he gets, the more and more money that he makes, the more selfish he becomes. Although, this is a morality tale, but it's not a simple one. He's not being selfish for his own sake, it's for his family's sake. The certainly good to the film makes you think, well, is that actually being selfish then? And rather than preaching about it, lets you decide for yourself. Reza Naji's already won the Silver Bear Award at this year's Berlin Film Festival for his portrayal of Kazim, and I'd have to say that is thoroughly deserved. The whole film's from his perspective, and Naji is entirely capable of carrying the whole thing. He's almost instantly likeable, and clearly a gifted comic actor, and the character's temptations and dilemmas are very, very believably played. It's just, the film is just thoroughly bloody nice, which is, it's something of a rarity, and it's just nice to see. How many more times I can use the word nice, I'm not sure, but I'm going to carry on and see. In a way that describing a film as nice can be seen as damning with faint praise, or possibly just damning it. But sometimes it's just, for want of a better word, nice to see a film that is nice. As I said, it's a morality tale, it's not a preachy one. And it's certainly enough to get you thinking about what you're doing in the same situations. And it's dressed in a pleasant, gentle comedy that's going to leave you feeling happy and pleased you took the time to watch it.
Good stuff. The only comment I've got from this, reading through the press blurb for it, is that it features from the lead a performance of clownish physicality. Now, from what you're saying, it actually sounds like a good film, so I'm assuming that, well, the description clownish is erroneous, because clowns aren't funny.
No, if it were funny, clowns wouldn't be doing it. And I can't really think of anything in the film that could really be called clownish. I mean, there are probably a few instances of physical humour, but not a lot, and certainly aren't any pratfalls. So I can only assume that person didn't watch it.
Well,
or was an idiot.
As I have gleaned from press notes over the years, they are generally completely wrong, so not massively surprised to hear that.
So, Scott, while I was seeing the Song of Sparrows, I believe you were seeing a Chinese film called The Red Dawn. Like, care to enlighten us?
Surely will. Set in rural China, it is essentially the tale of a father and his son. Relationships between the father, played by Yao Anlian, and his son, Lu Yulai, are somewhat strained, as evidenced by a couple of counts of attempted murder on the child's part after his father nonchalantly wanders back into his life after an absence of 5 years while he's been trying to make money in the city. He's actually already had his father declared legally dead at the same point as his mother died, but over the course of the film, their relationship does improve somewhat, although it would be hard to see how it could possibly have gone downhill. The father and son ply their trade with a fellow villager touring the countryside in a pretty red combination harvester as a kind of mercenary harvesting team, hiring themselves out to other farmers not yet all mechanised. As an excuse for writer and debut director Kai Shang-jun to show some stunning pastoral landscapes, it's pretty much peerless, but there are a few more strings to its bow than a simple feast for the eyes. It is, however, not the paciest film you'll ever see. The revelations as to why the lead's relationship has fallen to some disrepair are somewhat long in coming, and the pair's backstory is similarly slow to develop. In absolute terms, there's not much earth-shattering going on, but it's certainly worth waiting for when it does arrive. It's not ever going to be the most event-filled film in the world, but it does manage to provide a slow, burning, brooding tension between the pair that, for the most part, holds interest well over the piece. It could perhaps do with being about a quarter of an hour, as, despite compelling, near-mute performances from the leads, staring menacingly or wistfully at the camera, depending on how the mood takes them, can only go so far before it becomes a little bit repetitive. Perhaps the main part of the appeal is the strong cinematography. The colours are bold and vibrant throughout. It really shows off the beauty of the countryside. This only really vanishes towards the end of the film, where the pair go into the city to try and come up with some sort of new life for themselves. And at that point, it turns into a city film, and cities are generally very grey, dull things, and this is no exception. There's perhaps some element of the director railing against the modernisation of Chinese culture, and if there is, it's possibly stretching an allegory to breaking point. However, even with this perhaps pretension at social commentary aside, it remains a very interesting film, very good film, very visually impressive film, and certainly I would imagine one of the better films that you'll see during this festival time.
That's something I'd like to look out, although you mentioned beautiful pastoral landscapes, and I would take that with a note of caution. I've not seen it, so I wouldn't dismiss it. I've never found pastoral landscapes particularly appealing. I tend to scream out for mountains, but I'll take your word just now and certainly give it a look.
Really? Okay. How often do you scream out for mountains? I don't actually think this is true. I've known you a long time, and you've never once sort of went, mountains!
But generally, where I live, I can see mountains, so I've never had much need to.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure about that.
Okay, having covered that film from China, next up we saw another film from Southeast Asia, this time from South Korea, a film called The Milky Way Liberation Front. Would you like to tell us something about that, Scott?
Not massively, no.
I hear you.
Quite what I'm supposed to say about The Milky Way Liberation Front is something of a mystery. It's... where to start, really? It is
possibly with the word meh.
or at least, the sort of film for which the words wacky and zany and oddball seem to be made for.
Words that tend to turn me off.
Yeah, pish is also another good word for it. It is essentially a haphazard collection of skits that could, with a bit of latitude and squinting, be called a plot, concerning a young writer-director attempting to get his first film project off the ground, despite the slight handicap of it not actually being written yet. He continues on assembling a team, and if that sounds somewhat conventional for your tastes, then please rest assured that the bulk of the story is quite effectively obscured under several layers of completely impenetrable film student-level bullshit. Things will lapse into black and white, there's bizarre framing changes, and by the time the lead character's voice is replaced by a harmonica, that starts to seem to make sense within the context of the film. Well, I would love to say that it all makes perfect sense when you're sat in front of it and it flows and is a wonderful, happy experience for all concerned, but to be honest, it's not really. Any actual point that was ever to be made about the filmmaking process has been completely buried under 40-odd foot of pretension, and it can't even be enjoyed on the level of a screwball comedy, as it simply isn't funny enough, often enough, to coast by on that level. Even in my most generous mood, the first hour is utterly dismal. Perhaps after that it picks up a little bit, but I certainly can't defend it very much, and I certainly cannot recommend that anyone pony up the £8 to go and see it. It is, as far as I understand, a demo reel for the young group of filmmakers behind the film. While it does show that they can do various different styles of cinema, it just proves that when you throw them all together in one big ball and kick it down a hill, it doesn't actually produce a very good film at the end of it.
No, it is quite a chore to watch, mostly because from one minute to the next it can't quite decide what it wants to be.
Mm-hmm.
And your point about the use of the phrase film student is spot on, because what it feels like is a rather supercilious student film where they've decided in the bloom of youth that all other films are rubbish. Look at all this Korean cinema. It's rubbish, but we are great. Yeah. And we'll put this together, but without realising, oh, wait a minute, this doesn't actually work as a film.
Yeah.
We like all of these styles. Let's steal them and stick them in here. But it's all just a huge mishmash.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of these things that, even again, we'd look through the press notes that says, oh, it's, yes, it is pretentious, but it's aware of how pretentious it's being, as though that somehow makes it all right.
as if that were a good thing.
It's fucking terrible, but it knows that it's fucking terrible, so you're not allowed to say that it's fucking terrible. It's like, well, screw that, it's fucking terrible.
It's somehow postmodern pretension.
Yes.
No, it still isn't any good, which is really the point.
No, it's clever because it's terrible. Yeah, okay, whatever.
Or I would say it's really more just terrible because it's terrible, and let's leave it at that.
Yeah. Okay, so leave it at that, we will. Next up, not one that I didn't take in, but I know that Drew did, based perhaps on the Brian Cox performance, but it is Red. What say you, man? What say you?
Yeah, well, certainly, given a plentiful choice of films this morning to see, lumped for the one with Brian Cox in it because I thought it was at least guaranteed a good performance, and I'm happy to say I wasn't disappointed. Cox plays Avery Ludlow, a retired soldier who, after a family tragedy a decade ago, lives quietly alone with only his dog Red for company. One afternoon, he's out fishing at a local lake, and he's approached by three youths purportedly out hunting deer. The leader of these three is one Danny McCormack, played by the Richie's Noel Fisher, who's nothing more nor less than a teenage recidivist, and with him are his partner in crime, Pete, and Danny's fearful younger brother, Harold. They approach Avery and they begin questioning about his fishing, seemingly casually. There's all the while this sense of danger, and after Avery has the gall to suggest that the reason they have seen no deer is the overpowering smell of Danny's gun oil, the clearly unstable Danny decides to try to rob Avery. Finding that he has the temerity to have almost nothing worth their stealing, Danny, being the thoroughly well-adjusted young chap that he is, decides to punish the old man for his poverty by discharging his shotgun to his dog Red's skull. Obviously he's shocked by this, and Avery decides to do a little detective work and finds out Danny's name and confronts his father, played by a decidedly wired-looking Tom Sizemore, although nowadays it's probably not any other type of Tom Sizemore. He confronts him with Danny's behaviour. McCormack Sr. is, for all his success, big house and trophy wife, a barely restrained thug. Thug? Yes. He's a barely restrained thug.
Thug.
If anybody works out what that is, you can contact us at podcast@oneliner.com. Otherwise, I will assume I meant thug and tell you so. For all his success, he's a barely restrained thug and refuses to believe Ludlow. Having failed to get McCormack's father to take any action, Avery Ludlow then takes his story first to the police and then to a reporter who produces a piece for local TV about the murder of his dog, rather than bringing about the desired effect of encouraging the reluctant district attorney to prosecute the case. It instead proves the catalyst for a series of increasingly severe attacks upon Avery's business and person. I don't want to say too much more about it because it's a thriller and you don't want to give away too much of the plot, so I'll leave it at that. What I will tell you though, as a thriller, it's fairly unremarkable, though it's undoubtedly an above average one. But the film is definitely lifted by Brian Cox's typically powerful central performance and strong support from Noel Fisher as the deeply unlikable and unstable Danny, and Tom Sizemore as his unreconstructed Brit of a father. At first I thought it was going to be more of a drama, and it was going to go along on getting justice as a point of principle and possibly the right not to live in fear, but it becomes a thriller in the end, but it's certainly worth seeing, and as anybody who's seen Brian Cox knows, he's almost always worth watching, and I would certainly highly recommend this. It's got a good chance of getting a fairly wide cinematic release, so if this sounds interesting to you, you should be able to find it easily enough without having to rent it or anything, but even if you only have to rent it, it's certainly, if you like Brian Cox, it's yet another film very well worth watching, and you won't be disappointed.
It being a film festival at all, most of these films haven't been released yet. Many of these films will never be seen again in this country and will evaporate into the ether. But obviously there are a few that are already picked up and have their distribution deals ready and are just there for the hype more than anything else. So hopefully we'll get to see that. One film which is part of the under the radar section of the Edinburgh Film Festival, and God, I wish it had stayed under the radar, is a film called Crack Willow, which is simply pure cinematic filth. It is the sort of thing that if you put this in front of any normal audience, it would be booed off screen within about 20 seconds. It is the sort of nonsense that film festivals sort of make their money on, of having these films that are, they're edgy and experimental, which generally just means completely worthless. And
surely you're missing the important PR type word, which is provocative.
Yes.
Which generally means offensively bad.
Yeah, let me tell you, there's nothing more provocative and edgy that you'll see in a cinema this year, because Crack Willow is god-awful. I'm not exactly sure what I did in this life for the sum total of all my previous lives to deserve the horror perpetrated upon my eyeballs that is Crack Willow. There wouldn't seem to be any crime serious enough to warrant this sort of self-flagellation that sitting in front of this, for want of a better term, film constitutes. It starts off, at least, if not well, conventionally enough, with a fellow called Mark finding himself caring for his elderly father in between bouts of social inadequacy and casual insults hurled against anyone he seems to happen across. Soon afterwards, his father dies, leaving him parentless and completely bereft of anything resembling a narrative. What unfolds after this, across various different characters who pop up and vanish with little rhyme or reason, could, I suppose, be considered something of a study in mental health. However, one would have to be displaying about the same level of charity to the script as Mother Teresa did during the course of her life. Not to the script necessarily, but just charity in general. I hear she was big on the thing. What you get from this film, in real terms, is a fat guy who's had his shoes stolen insulting a prostitute and a guy at a bus stop, a guy who A guy who grumbles a primary school level psychotic script down the telephone to his mother while atonal aphex twin on a lobotomy level drivel pounds away in the background, and a woman who stares in silence at someone doing a clown act before a guy playing the trumpet badly eventually makes her crack a smile. And if any of that condenses out into some form of message or point, it can probably only be described as an accident rather than a design. This embarrassing mess of banal obscenity and entirely gratuitous full frontal nudity bounces around making no sense whatsoever for so long that it seems to be making a point of pride in not making any sort of sense. I'm fairly certain that I've had bowel movements that are more worthy of a place on the cinema screen than this is. It was described in the PR blurb, which I've already, we've discussed, not the most reliable of sources, described as being sort of like Mike Lee meets Chris Morris. It's really more like a steaming great pile of shite meeting a steaming great bowl of shite. It is just about as close to a baseline of awfulness as I've seen in a cinema. And by this point in our podcast, you've probably known that we've seen a lot of terrible films. This is perhaps the worst. It is almost an absolute zero. It has no redeeming features whatsoever. And again, I know that the PR blurb is done by Hannah McGill, who organises this festival and is supposed to have some sort of clue. I can only assume she was on the crazy pills that day. But, oh, good grief, what a terrible, terrible film.
Yeah, you mentioned there about people having listened to our podcast knowing we've seen an awful lot of bad stuff, and anybody who's familiar with the one liner will know that our benchmark for shitty awfulness in cinema is the monstrosity that was Full Frontal. Mm. So on a rating of awfulness, how close to Full Frontal is it?
It is perhaps worse than Full Frontal. Full Frontal was at least conventionally tedious, where this is going out of its way to be oddball and strange, but it just turns out to be a complete mess. It is, again, it's the sort of thing that's described in PR tones as its rejection of conventional narrative form and jarring shifts in emotional tone as though they are good things. They are not.
Generally means the scriptwriter couldn't keep a storyline going for more than a few pages.
Well, that is exactly right. I mean, there's very little story here, and when it does, it is terrible and then never explained as to what any of these little vignettes are supposed to mean. Just because something is different does not make it good, and this is certainly not good.
I think I might watch it, but I'm chewing razor blades that night.
just pass them round. As long as I don't have to see it again in my life, I'll be happy.
All right, next up is a film from South America, to be precise, Argentina, a horror, which, being from Argentina, makes it already different from the slew of Japanese and American horrors we're normally subjected to. This film's called The Appeared, and Scott, let's let the people know about this.
Pablo, played by Javier Piera, and Malena, Ruth Diaz, comprise a brother and sister duo who are about to pull the plug on their clinically brain-dead father's life support machine, which is a particularly cheery introduction. Malena seems to have no qualms about doing this, having not had the happiest of upbringings at her father's hands, but Pablo is a little more reluctant, having barely known their father before their mother split with their father and emigrated out of the country to Spain. Pablo declares that before he can give consent to pull the plug on his father, he and his sister must bust their father's car out of storage and go on a road trip back to their old family house to find out just a little bit more about his father, which sounds like a heartwarming little drama, but that is derailed quickly when they find a mysterious diary in the car, which is full of grisly details and photographs of murders that have taken place some 20 years or so ago. Soon, as is often the way in this sort of thing, odd events start to unfold as spectres of the past appear to put the willies right up our protagonists. Said events of the subtlety of a half-brick hurled through a window, although it's hardly uncommon in the genre, nor is it necessarily a bad thing in a horror. However, in a script that has at least as much of a pretension at being an investigative thriller along the lines of the subplots in The Ring and so forth, it's a little more problematic. The other major problem that we have to point out, what with it being a horror film and all, is that it's not particularly scary. It's not the sort of film I'm desperately happy being negative about. It's better produced than it's more imaginative than pretty much every horror film so far this year, certainly more than the selection of terrible ones that we've seen, you know, Creep, Cursed, Doomsday, Darkness Falls, Devil's Gates, Wrong Turn, I could go on forever.
But please don't, I may scream with the memory.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly leagues ahead of those. The lead performances from Pereira and Diaz are never less than competent and evoke at least some measure of compassion with them, and it's well captured by the writer-director, Paco Cabezas. He seems to be attempting to build horror through the lead character's reactions rather than just sort of playing loud noises at you, which I appreciate. It's just a shame that it doesn't actually work all that well. It's full of the sort of conveniences that you would tend to find in silly little ghost stories like this. And any relationship, as is implied by the title, to Argentina's disappeared hinges almost entirely on one character Milena happens about for no earthly reason whatsoever, just unloading her life story about what happened during that little regime. And
it's the most tenuous of connections to what happened during the military dictatorship.
Yeah,
it's odd years ago.
For some reason, that's played up more than anything else, and it has no place being played up. It's an acceptable enough horror film if you're looking for a horror film in the middle of a festival where, perhaps contrary to the evidence of much of this podcast, we're at least hoping we'll find some good films. It's not really worth seeking out compared to some of the hopefully better films that we'll see over the coming couple of weeks.
I would agree, but it was very well acted. The character certainly had my compassion, but I have to say that I hate horror films. I despise horror films, and I try to be as open-minded about everything I watch as possible. And I'm always welcoming the chance of being proven wrong or being surprised. I genuinely am, but I just find myself for a lot of it thinking, oh good, another shitty horror that isn't actually scary. And the word shitty is perhaps a bit strong. I mean, it is a bit better than most of the draws you see, but it's not a genre I'm fond of, and what you might think is the big revelation isn't, especially if you're paying attention at all towards the start of the film, when there's a massive visual clue as to what's going on, although I won't spoil it for you in case you don't notice. If you're into horror, then I would suggest you probably go and watch this, because you know, it's probably something a bit different from what you're used to, and that's always good. But if you're like me and don't like horror, I wouldn't suggest, even though it's a bit better than many of them, going to see it, because it's really not that good.
Yeah, so it's definitely a very polished genre piece, but I don't think it's really going to have much of a crossover appeal to, you know, people, well, folks like us who normally just equate horror with rubbish. So
yeah, which is generally a pretty fair equation.
Yeah.
But yeah, and if you like horror, then I think you might get something from us. It's just interesting to watch horror from a different country. Mm-hmm. But if you don't like horror, then don't bother.
Yeah. So next up, Drew saw a film that I can't pronounce. So Drew, what was this film?
This is the Kreutzer Sonata, and the story goes that at the end of the 19th century, the Russian writer Leo Tolstoy heard Beethoven's Kreutzer Sonata for the first time, and he was so moved by the piece that he decided to write a story inspired by the music, and this film by Bernard Rose is the most recent to be based on Tolstoy's story. It's about a man called Edgar, a wealthy man from Los Angeles who seems to make his money by giving money away from his family's foundation for medical charities, and frankly I'm buggered if I know how that works and makes him money, but he seems to do very well in it. And at a party he meets married classical pianist Abby, played by Ellie Laws Elizabeth Rome, and falls immediately in love. The feeling is mutual, and soon the pair are indulging in an illicit affair. Unsurprisingly, Abby leaves her husband to be with Edgar, but their life together is changed completely by an unexpected pregnancy. I mean, come on now, unexpected. Who'd have thought all that shagging could possibly produce a child? What are the chances of that? In a few years' time, Abby's dropped another sprog, and the family have moved to a mansion in Beverly Hills, this giving money away working very, very well for Edgar. And it certainly seems to have been no suggestion that he was embezzling anything. Abby, though, is deeply unhappy. Apparently spending the equivalent of the GDP of a small country is not enough to keep the stroppy cow from moping about all of the time. And feels deeply unfulfilled. I don't do anything I love anymore, she moans to Edgar, consuming vast sums of money apparently having been a chore to her. So Edgar, who's also deeply unhappy, his solution is for her to play piano at an upcoming benefit for one of his foundation's charity projects, and he arranges for a young and virile violinist to perform the Kreutzer Sonata with her. Almost immediately though, Edgar begins feeling deeply jealous and paranoid about the relationship between the two musicians, and the film is really a study of the effects of destructive and obsessive jealousy. It was shot in an incredibly short time, 6-hour days for 20 days to produce this film, which is some of the most efficient filmmaking I've heard of, and it's not any of the worst for it. In fact, it's probably better. A lot of it's improvised, but with the handheld camera, it feels very intimate, and it's probably one of the most natural feeling films in terms of dialogue and performance I've seen in a long time. I think we're very conditioned from most films into sort of feeling the way that people speak in movies and theatre as being what you'd expect, and it's entertaining, but it's almost never how people speak.
Yeah.
And the occasional time when you do see people speaking naturally in a film, unless it's done very, very well, it feels like bad acting because it doesn't feel like how people speak in a film.
Yeah.
Fortunately, this doesn't fall into that trap. It's very well acted. It's very, very natural. Unfortunately, it's not the most interesting story. It's not the most compelling anyway. But Danny Houston and Elizabeth Rome work extremely well together. Intimate, real feeling dialogue and interactions. And it's only somewhat spoiled by an entirely unnecessary voiceover by Danny Houston, where he's speaking in what feels like lengthy prose and almost poetry about his feelings, which is, comes through entirely well in all of his on-screen scenes. And the sort of prose-like narration just jars totally with the wonderfully natural dialogue on screen.
Yeah, well, it worked for the Wonder Years, didn't it?
I was discussing with another reviewer at the end of the film too, but there are almost no films that can't probably be improved by the removal of their voiceover. For most of them, it can be dropped. It's certainly in this because it serves to undo all the good work done on screen. But it's certainly worth watching because Houston and Rome's performances are excellent, and just to see something sort of done in a way to seem natural but done so well is rare, and for that point of view, it's worth seeing. Not going to be the most rewarding in terms of story, but certainly it's a technical piece. I would recommend it.
No, good stuff. So, despite being described as a mature, complex, emotional drama, that shouldn't put us off.
No. I mean, it is mature, although, and there's quite a lot of fairly vigorous sex in it, but...
Oh, boobies.
Yes, boobies. Danny Houston's, no. Yes, boobies. And Danny Houston's arse. Whatever floats your boat, I guess.
That's a bit harsh. You were appraising him a moment ago. Now you're saying he's arse. Sorry.
Corner. Now, the sex doesn't feel out of place because it's a large foundation of the character's relationship, and it's certainly what got them together in the first place, and it's the fuel for Edgar's incredible and destructive jealousy.
Yeah.
So it doesn't feel out of place, but yeah, I have no qualms about recommending people see this at all.
Continuing the slightly more upbeat theme of this little section of the podcast is a film called We Went to Wonderland, which I was interested in seeing because about 2 years ago, I believe it was, there was a film from a young Chinese director called Xiaologu, I believe, which was called And How Was Your Fish Today? And that's the sort of film that you go and see purely on the basis of the title. turned out to be quite a little treat, in part biographical, it was part fiction, it was part documentary, and it was part something else entirely, and it was certainly one of the more memorable and interesting films of that year. So seeing a new film from her was always going to be high on the agenda. This one doesn't show anything like the inventiveness of that past effort. It's still charming enough to warrant at least a small portion of your attention, though. That said, writing any sort of plot synopsis for it is not going to sound massively promising. Gao picks up a black and white camera and follows her mother and father around as they take a trip to Europe to see both their daughter and the local sites. It's part travelogue and it's part exploration of an elder Chinese generation's attitude to the Western world, that being the titular Wonderland conceit. The obviously personal element of this film does allow for a great deal of charm to sally forth from the screen. Gao's father has suffered from throat cancer and has had his voice box removed and can now only communicate by writing notes to show us. While this provides an interesting narrative hook to hang the fuller on, it also means that often his statements appear as flashing white text on a plain black background, which unfortunately puts one in mind of a Monty Python skit, and I kept expecting Graham Chapman to show up and declare it was all being far too silly. This doesn't happen, although sometimes it seems that it should, regardless of how interestingly shot this is. And even while capturing fairly mundane events and locales, Gal has a great eye for details and framing. There's this inescapable feeling that the film reduces to little more than What My Parents Did on Their Holiday, a video essay by this director aged 8.5. that's been a little harsh. There's probably little of devastatingly original cultural commentary on show here, what with Gal the Elder's major criticism of Western culture seemingly being that the garbage isn't collected frequently enough. But it doesn't stop it being a lovely, engaging little tale of life's less ordinary than my dismal little existence. Visually very pretty, interesting enough, but if you're the sort of person who really doesn't want to see anyone else's holiday photographs, then you might not be so interested in this film. I think it has some merit, but actually convincing people that it does have merit is proving to be quite difficult. But if you do happen across this, I would recommend checking it out. And if it's ever possible to see her previous film, And How Was Your Fish Today, which I don't believe has had a DVD release even in this country, so it was proving a little difficult to track down. But if you ever get a chance to see that film, it's certainly far better to watch than this one. But I think either are good films.
I had been going to ask you there, well, you'd have suggested the first film in preference to this if you got a choice of both of them.
Yeah.
Tell me, it's an awesome name, but I wouldn't encourage any of our readers to follow our lead and go and watch a film simply on the strength of its name, because for every How Was Your Fish Today, there's a Milky Way Liberation Front, another film we went to see because of the name.
Yeah.
This was wrong.
Yes.
No. I regret this wholly.
Well, we've been prattling on for probably long enough here, but the 10th, count them 10, that we're going to cover today is probably, well, unarguably, I would say, the best of the bunch. Summer's Town, the latest film from Shay Meadows.
One of the best directors currently working in Britain. I have yet to see a bad Shay Meadows film. And The Man from the Midlands continues his remarkable hitting streak with this tale of friendship in difficult circumstances in inner-city London. The story is that of Marek, played by Pieter Jagiello, a Polish immigrant who lives in a small flat with his father, who's a labourer on the nearby rejuvenation of St Pancras train station into London's Eurostar terminal. He's left much to his own devices, as his father works all day and spends most evenings drinking with his friends. Although, I wouldn't like you to think this means that he was a particularly bad father, which is not the case. It's not a bad life in that his father's not negligent, he's just perhaps otherwise engaged and necessarily busy.
As you mentioned, these kids are supposed to be about 16, 17, they can take care of themselves by that age.
Yeah, they're not just being left neglected on their own.
Yeah, but they're not being McCann'd.
No. So, though, he does know his father works hard, but certainly he misses his mother, and he's in a new country where he doesn't know many people and would like to spend more time with his father. So he's a rather sad young man and frightfully bored. So he whiles away his hours taking photographs of the Summers Town area where he lives and doing odd jobs for local Del Boy wannabe Graham, played by Perry Benson, until a chance meeting in a cafe one day with Tomo, played by This Is England's Thomas Turgus, who's run away from the children's home where he lives in Nottingham. This provides both boys with something they both desperately need. That's friendship. There's not much more to say story-wise, it's just two friends getting to know each other, finding they have things in common, and enjoying life together, and some of the hardships it throws at them. It's shot entirely in black and white, or almost entirely, but the film just radiates sunshine. Mm-hmm. It's just genuinely and pleasingly uplifting. And I think for a film, an uplifting film from a director known for his somewhat bleaker view in the world, I really have to say that Shane Meadows' Summer's Town is everything Mike Leigh's happy-go-lucky was not, but should have been.
Exactly.
Yeah, Thomas Turgus was a real revelation in This Is England, and it shows here that it wasn't any fluke at all. It's unusual to see such skill and assuredness from somebody so young. It just promises hugely for the future, and he's certainly one to look out for. He's given more than adequate support, though, from young Paul Jagiello, whose quiet, understated performance as Marek complements perfectly Turgus's far more boisterous Tomo. And Scott's right in saying that this is the best of the films we've seen so far. It's a genuinely pleasant, uplifting, really happy film. I just can't really recommend that highly enough. It's a film that makes you feel good.
Not exactly. It's a great feel-good film. Again, this is one of these strange things where the actual press release from the film company, I can't even blame a press department this time, or the EIF press department at any rate, says that at one point one of the girls that they're fond of moves away. And at this point, the press release says, all is lost for the pair. At which point, I can only assume they were watching an entirely different film, because that simply misses out all of the, well, nice things that happens after this so-called devastating event didn't happen.
Yeah. And not all is lost. They're sort of young boys having been detached from their first love, but it's all part of the growing up thing.
Yeah,
all is not lost when they've got each other and they get through it. So in what way is all lost? The only way in all is lost, and it is not.
The relationship between Tomo and Marek is never less than utterly charming, as is their interaction with Maria, the object of their affections. Even the characters that lesser scripts would have set up as some way being evil or over-authoritarian to give some kind of pivot point to emphasise with the young leads doesn't happen. As you say, that the father's never sort of overbearing or anything like that. He just happens to have a slightly different interest, and he's never a bad guy. The Del Boy trotter like Graham is never, you suspect, might actually sort of attempt to be, you know, taking advantage of them to some great degree, but he doesn't do that either. He never comes across as anything other than realistically human and, well, again, for want of a better term, nice. It's just the kind of heartwarming film where you're reminded that, rather than sort of through any kind of forced happy ending or nonsense like that, just a simple, quiet reminder that a lot of people are in fact nice, and even the cold-hearted cynic like me will probably believe that most people are in fact fairly decent at heart. And this is just a timely reminder of it, rather than providing any sort of forced, against all odds kind of uplifting story like you've seen from umpteen million different films. This just shows you humans being human and actually being quite good at it.
Yeah, from that point of view, it rather reminds me of a film of a couple of years ago with Anthony Hopkins called The World's Fastest Indian, which was, it was a road movie, but a very, very pleasant one, in that it was just a man who met some nice people, and largely the case was that he was pleasant to people and dealt with people in a pleasant manner, so they were pleasant to him, and nice things happened.
Yeah.
And it didn't feel forced or unbelievable, so they were just people being reasonably decent, normal people, as most people probably really are.
Yeah, plus this does have people being happy in London, which is possibly the most unrealistic scenario you can think of, so even with that hampering it, it still manages to be an excellent film. I think I'm now getting to the point where I think that everyone else in British film should stop, and we'll just let Shane Meadows go, because I'm sure that's the only way we'll actually get the batting average up, but he seems to be very much the go-to guy in an industry which is still otherwise struggling to find anything of any use to latch on to, given some of the straws we've, even already looked at today in this podcast.
He's one of those people just you wish you could sort of clone and then perhaps tweak a bit so he did something slightly different.
Yeah,
but if you could clone him, it would be a good thing. I mean, as I said earlier, I've yet to see a bad Shane Meadows film.
Yeah,
and so long may that streak continue.
Certainly, by far and away the most recommended film that we've covered in this podcast. Probably I believe it's getting released fairly soon as well, and it will be probably one of the best films of the year, if not the best film of the year. It's certainly in contention, and certainly, I heartily advise everyone go out and see it.
I would second that. So that's it. That's the end of our first installment from the EIFF, but we'll be back with you shortly when we've seen our next glut of films. And until then, goodbye.
Ta-da!